Chapter 8. In the fall of 1953, Mary Ann Reynolds lived in a small apartment with a girl named Phyllis Squire. Phyllis was a waitress at the Golden State lunch counter, which was next door to the Lazy Wren, and Carlton Tweeny himself had selected her. Thereby he had solved in his own mind Mary Ann's problems. He did not now have much to do with her. For Mary Ann there was little more than the passage of his presence. Back and forth, not stopping, he went by and beyond her. The telephone company job she had taken required her to work a split shift. At 12:30 at night, she reached the apartment and ate and changed her clothes. As she changed, her roommate in bed read aloud from a copy of the Sermons of Fulton Sheen. "What's the trouble?" Phyllis asked, her mouth full of apple. In the corner, her white enamel radio played a Perez Prado mambo. "You're not listening." Ignoring her, Mary Ann slipped into her red culottes, stuffed in the tails of her shirt, and went to the door. "Don't go blind," she said over her shoulder and closed the door behind her. Noise and the movement of people flashed out into the dark street as she entered the Wren. Tables crowded with people, the line of men squeezed together at the bar. But Tweeny was not singing. She was aware of it instantly. The upraised platform in the center was bare. He was nowhere in sight. And even Paul Nitz was absent. "Hey," Taft Eaton said from behind the bar, "you get out of here, I'm not serving you." Avoiding him, she began threading among the tables, searching for a place to sit. "I mean it, you're a minor, you're not supposed to be in here. What do you want? You want me to lose my license?" His voice faded as she reached the platform. Slouched at the table was Paul Nitz, conversing with a pair of patrons. He had apparently left his piano to talk to them. Straddling a chair, leaning his bony chin against his arms, he was orating. "But you have to make a distinction between folk songs and folk-type songs, like jazz and music in the jazz idiom." The couple glanced up as she brought over a chair and seated herself. Nitz broke off what he was saying long enough to greet her. "How are you?"
"Fine," she said. "Where's Tweeny?"
"He just sang. He'll be back." She felt a surge of tension.
"Is he in the rear?"
"He probably is, but you can't go back there. Eaton'll throw you out on your ear." At the side of the table appeared Taft Eaton, still fuming. "God damn it, Mary, I can't serve you. If the cops find you in here, they'll close the Wren."
"Say I came in to use the John," she murmured.
Pretending to ignore him, she began sliding out of her coat. Eaton glowered at Nitz, who sat picking a bit of thread from his sleeve. "Don't you buy her anything. Contributing to the delinquency of minors, you and Carlton, you ought to be in jail." Taking her by the scruff of the neck, he said in her ear, "You ought to stay with your own race where you belong." Then he was gone, leaving Mary Ann to massage the back of her neck.
"Drop dead," she muttered.
It hurt, and she felt humiliated. But then, gradually, the pain left, and the need of Tweeny resumed its usual dominance.
"I'm going back and see if he's there."
"He'll be out," Nitz assured her. "Sit still, you and your hurry. Relax."
"I've got things to do. Where was he last night?"
"He was here."
"I don't mean here. I mean afterward. I went over to his pad at 2:30 and he wasn't home. He was out."
"Maybe so." Nitz dragged his chair around and returned to the listening couple. "Look at it this way, lady," he said, addressing the woman, a plump, somewhat pretty blonde. "Would you call Stephen Foster's stuff folk music?" The blonde considered at excessive length.
"No, I guess not. But it was based on folk themes."
"That's my point. Folk music is not what you have, but how you go about it. Nobody can plop himself down and write a folk song, and nobody can get up in white tie and tails in some plus cocktail lounge and sing a folk song."
"Does anybody sing folk music, then?"
"Not now, but they did once. They sang, they added verses, they put together new material constantly." She became aware of the nature of their discussion. It had to do with Tweeny, and they were attacking him.
"Don't you think he's a great folk singer?" she demanded, addressing the blonde.
In her world, loyalty was a vital pillar. She could not understand this veiled undercutting of a friend. It seemed her responsibility to defend him.
"What's wrong with him?"
"I've never heard him. We're still waiting."
"I'm not talking about Tweeny," Nitz said, evidently aware of his moral lapse. "Not particularly, I mean. I'm talking about folk music in general."
"But this Tweeny is a folk singer," the blonde said, "so where does he stand?"
Nitz uneasily sipped his drink. "It's hard to say. I'm just the intermission pianist, a mortal." "You don't like his stuff," the blonde's companion said with a knowing wink. "I'm a bop player,"
Mitz reddened and avoided the girl's accusing glare. "To me, folk music is like Dixie, a dead horse. It stopped growing back in the days of James Merritt Ives. Show me a folk song that's come down since then."
She was quite angry now. The need to defend Tweeny, to keep the greatness of him intact, made her bristle and say, "What about Old Man River?"
Tweeny sang Old Man River at least once a night, and it was one of her favorites. At that, Mitz grinned. "See what I mean? Old Man River was written by Jerome Kern."
He broke off, because at that moment there was applause, and Carlton Tweeny appeared on the raised platform. Instantly, the girl forgot Mitz, forgot the blonde and everything else. The conversation fell into a vacuum.
"Excuse me," Mitz murmured. He crawled back to his piano, dwarfed, she observed, by the huge figure of Tweeny. "For my first number," Tweeny rumbled in his furry sing-song, "I will sing a work that expresses the bitter terror of the Negro people in their ages of bondage. You may have heard it before." He paused. "Strange Fruit."
A flutter of excitement stirred the room as Nitz picked out a few opening chords. And then, his arms folded, his head down, forehead wrinkled in contemplation, Tweeny began. He did not raise his voice or shout. He did not bellow or snarl or shake his fist. Thoughtful, deeply moved, he spoke directly to the people around him. It was a highly personal communication, and not a concert rendition. When he had finished telling them the story of life in the South, there was silence. Nobody clapped. The people clustered around, waited with fearful expectancy, as Tweeny considered his next communication. "My people," he murmured, "have suffered greatly in their chains and tribulations. Their lot has not been a happy one. But the Negro can sing about his privations. This is a song from the heart of the Negro people. In it he expresses his deeply felt sufferings, but at the same time, his genuine humor. He is innately a happy person. What he wants is the simple things of life. Enough to eat, a place to sleep, and most important, a woman."
Carlton Tweeny thereupon sang, "Got grasshoppers in my pillow, baby, got crickets all in my meal."
Marianne listened tensely, following every word, her eyes on the man a few feet from her. In the last months, she had not been close to Tweeny. Except for these public moments, she had seen little of him. She wondered if he was singing to her. She tried to find in his words some special reference to herself and things they had done together. Bland and withdrawn, Tweeny continued to sing, not noticing her, apparently unaware of her. Beside her, the blonde listened, too. Her companion was uninterested. Sunk down in a brooding heap, he squeezed and pressed a piece of wax that had dripped from the candle.
"For my last number," Tweeny declared when he had finished, "I shall sing a composition that has found special favor in the hearts of Americans, both Caucasian and Negro. It is a song that unites all of us in memories as we near the moment in which we celebrate the birth of one who died to redeem us all, whatever our race, whatever our color."
Half closing his eyes, Tweeny sang White Christmas. At the piano, Paul Nitz plunked chords dutifully. Marianne, as she listened to the tune grind along, wished she could tell what was in the minds of the two men. Nitz, hunched over at the keys, seemed merely bored, as if he were pushing a broom, she reflected. She felt indignation at Nitz's betrayal of artistry. Was that all it meant to him, as if he were on an assembly line? She hated him for betraying Tweeny. It was an insult to Tweeny. He could show some feeling. And Tweeny, what, if anything, was he thinking? It seemed almost as if there was a cynical smile on Tweeny's face, an emptiness that could have been the most muted kind of contempt. But contempt for whom? For the song? But he had picked it. For the people listening? As he sang, or rather muttered out the lyrics, Tweeny's expression began to undergo a metamorphosis. The detachment began to fade. In its place appeared a fervor. His voice took on a throbbing sublimity, a grandeur that grew until he appeared to be vibrating with pain. There was no doubting his emotions. Tweeny loved the song. He was terribly moved, and he was communicating that to the audience. When he had finished, there was once more the interval of silence, and then the applause exploded wildly. Tweeny stood, shaken, his face impassioned. Then gradually grief sank, and the half-cynical listlessness returned. Tweeny shrugged, straightened his expensive hand-painted necktie, and stepped to the floor. "Tweeny!"
Marianne called shrilly, jumping to her feet. "Where were you last night? I came over and you were at home."
With a faint twitch of his eyebrows, two lines of expressive, cultivated black, Tweeny acknowledged her existence. He stepped over to the table and stood for a moment with his hand on the chair Nitz had vacated. The blonde said,
"Why don't you join us?"
"Thank you," Tweeny replied. He rotated the chair and seated himself. "I'm tired."
"Don't you feel good?"
Marianne asked, concerned. He did look wilted. "Not so good." Nitz dropped down beside him and said, "I hate that goddamn White Christmas worse than any other tune in the business. The joker that wrote that should be shot." Sadness overcame Tweeny. "Oh," he murmured, "do you feel that?" Sipping his drink, Nitz said, "What do you know about the sufferings of the Negro people? You were born in Oakland, California." The blonde, to Mary's annoyance, leaned forward and addressed Tweeny.
"That song about grasshoppers, that's an old Leadbelly tune, isn't it?"
Tweeny nodded. "Yes, Leadbelly used to sing that before he passed away."
"Did he record it?"
"He did," Tweeny said absently. "But it's not available now. It's more or less a collector's item."
"Maybe Joe has it," the blonde said to her companion.
"Ask him," her companion said, without enthusiasm. "You're in there enough." The discussion of folk music resumed, and Marianne managed to catch Tweeny's attention.
"You didn't say where you were last night," she said accusingly.
A cunning smile settled over Tweeny's face. The usual film glazed his eyes until they were a dulled, dispassionate gray. "I was busy. I've been rather occupied the last few weeks."
"Months, you mean?"
Half listening to Nitz and the blonde rambling on about Blind Lemon Jefferson, Tweeny asked, "How's the Pacific Tell-and-Tell?"
"Lousy."
"I'm sorry to hear that." In a clear voice, Marianne informed him,
"I'm going to quit."
"Already?"
"No, not until I have something else. I've learned my lesson."
"You wish you were back at the furniture place? Ask them, they'll take you back."
"Don't kid me, I wouldn't go back there on a bet."
"Suit yourself," Tweeny shrugged. "It's your life."
"Why did you throw me out when I came to you that day?"
"I didn't throw you out. I don't recall doing that."
"You wouldn't let me move my things over. You made me keep a separate address, and after a week you wouldn't let me stay all night. I had to get up and leave. That's what I call being thrown out."
He regarded her with wonder. "Are you out of your mind? You know the situation. You're underage. It's a felony."
"If it's a felony to do it at 3 o'clock in the morning, it's a felony to do it in the afternoon."
"I thought you understood."
"If it's a felony..."
"Keep your voice down," Tweeny said with a glance at Nitz and the couple.
Now they were involved in a discussion of contemporary atonal experiments.
That was only now and then, not a thing they could catch.
"Now and then? Temporary?"
She was furious, really furious, because she remembered what it was convenient for him to forget. That specific day he had taken her into his apartment, the two of them lost among the clutter that filled the rooms, two living creatures bedded together among the pack rat's hoard. And the hot summer sun baking the flies that crept up the window panes, lying the two of them slippery with sweat, covered by nothing, spread out on the bed with the glare blinding them into an indolent, careless stupor. There in that high loft they had eaten their breakfast, had shared the old bathtub, had cooked and ironed, had roamed naked through the rooms, playing the little piano, had sat in the evening, listening to the radio, staring into the red button of its dial light, the two of them combined on the couch, on the sagging, dust-sodden couch. Although, according to Tweeny, she was not much good that way. She had learned, been taught, to rest her weight on her shoulder blades and not on her coccyx. That way she could raise her hips higher. But other than purely muscular tensions, she had developed no responses. The experience brought her nothing, and nothing was what she gave back. It was to her very like the time the doctor had stuck his metal probe into her nose to break off a polyp. The same pressure, the same too large physical unit forcing its way inside her. Then pain, and a little blood, and the crickets chirping in the grass of the yard below the window. Tweeny said she was no good, small and bony and frigid. Gordon, of course, had no opinion. He expected nothing but concavity, and that was what he got. No more and no less.
"Tweeny," Marianne said, "you can't pretend we haven't been..."
"Don't get upset," Tweeny said silkily. "You'll get ulcers."
Marianne leaned toward him until her small, tight face was almost touching his. "What have you been doing the last 2 months?" Absolutely nothing, except my art.
You're staying with somebody. You're never at home. I waited one night all night and you didn't show up. You didn't come home.
Tweeny shrugged. I was visiting.
Next to them, the discussion had become heated.
I never heard of that, Nitz was saying.
You could have, the blonde told him. Don't you have a radio? Every Wednesday night, Joe has a program over that San Mateo Good Music Station. Listen to that. He writes up his material. He likes to do it all himself.
I tried listening to that stuff, Nitz said, but I can't get with it. It's old.
Lapsing into silence, Marianne withdrew into her own thoughts. The conversation meant nothing to her.
It's not old. It's still going on. The same material you are doing, only they don't call it by the same name. Mio up in Oakland, and Roger Sessions is at Berkeley. Go listen to him. Sid Heffel is at Palo Alto. He's about the best there is. Joe knows him. They're old friends.
I thought it was nothing but Mozart, Nitz said.
The blonde continued, on Sunday when the shop is closed, Joe has a 2-hour record concert. You should go.
You mean people just walk in?
15 or so people show up. He plays atonal, early Baroque, whatever they want. With a flicker of her blue eyes, she glanced up at Tweeny. I saw you there. You showed up once.
That's so, Tweeny admitted. You brought out a tray of coffee for us halfway through.
Did you enjoy yourself?
Very much. That's an extraordinary shop he has.
What's that?
Marianne said sharply. She woke up then. The conversation had ceased to be abstract. Now it was dealing with reality, and she began to pay attention.
The new record shop, Tweeny said.
Marianne turned to confront the blonde.
Do you know that man? She demanded, recalling in a rush the record shop, the looming shape of the man with his vest and gold watch and tweed suit.
Joe? The blonde smiled. Oh, yes. We're old friends of Joe's.
Where'd you meet him?
She experienced a kind of horror as if she were being told about some personal crime. In Washington, D.C.
You're from out of town, aren't you?
Yes, the blonde said.
He's really on the level?
Her distress was real again, but after 4 months it no longer had the same urgency. It had thinned as it receded into time. It was not immediate.
Joe has been in the music business all his life, the blonde said. His aunt sold harps in Denver during the Spanish-American War.
Joe worked for Century Music in New York in the '20s, before you were born.
Brooding, Marianne said, I don't like it in there.
Why not?
It gives me the creeps.
Not wishing to discuss it, Marianne said to Tweeny, when are you going to leave? Are you doing another set or not?
Tweeny pondered. I believe I'll go lie down. No, I won't do another set. I've done enough for tonight.
The blonde was still studying Marianne with interest.
What do you mean? Why do you say that about Joe's store?
Struggling, Marianne answered, it's not the store.
That was certainly true. She had loved the store.
Did something happen?
No, nothing.
She shook her head irritably. Forget it, will you? All at once the fear came back, and she said to Tweeny, do you really go in there?
Certainly, Tweeny said.
It seemed difficult to believe.
But that's the man I told you about.
Tweeny had no comment.
Did you like him?
Marianne asked.
A gentleman, Tweeny stated. We had quite an interesting talk about Bascom Lamar Lunsford. He played an ancient Lunsford record for me, cut around 1927, from his private collection.
Bewildered by this double set of images, Marianne said, you never told me you went in there.
Why? What's the importance? Tweeny seemed unconcerned. I'd go wherever I care to.
Paul Nitz could no longer keep quiet.
You suppose he'd give me a few pointers? He asked.
Joe has worked with a number of young musicians, the blonde said. He gave me a great deal of help. He got some pieces of mine published. Right now he's plugging a kid he heard singing up in San Francisco at one of the North Beach joints. He's been taping his routine and trying to get one of the LP companies to press it.
Chad Lemming, her companion said. What sort of approach does he represent? Tweeny asked with professional interest.
Chad does political monologues, the blonde said, with a guitar, sort of rhymed commentaries on the present state of affairs. Thought control, Senator McCarthy, topics like that. Would you care to hear him?
I suppose, Tweeny said.
The blonde got promptly to her feet. Come along, then.
Where?
He's at our place. He's staying with us until he goes back up the peninsula. He'll only be down here a few days.
Marianne watched with dismay the response of Carlton Tweeny. What was happening was obvious, but she could think of nothing to do.
And then Nitz,
mild, eyes half shut, came to her rescue. "You've got another set, man," he said.
"I'm tired," Tweeny said. "I'll let it go this time."
"You can't." O'Toole overcame Tweeny. He clearly was not giving up.
"I can't perform creatively when I'm tired."
"Then come on," the blonde urged. As if responding to an occult power, Taft Eaton approached the table, his bar rag oozing bubbles in a trail across the floor.
"One more set, Carlton. You're not leaving."
"Certainly not," Tweeny agreed.
Grinning with a wink at Marianne, Nitz said, "Tough luck. Anyhow, this lemming might start singing folk songs." With his usual profound gravity, Tweeny turned back to the blonde. She was still standing, still smiling at him, on the verge of leaving.
"Perhaps," Tweeny said, in a tone Marianne well recognized, "you could bring him over to my place. I'll be there directly I complete this final set."
Then it settled, a little quiver of her hips, a quite visible undulation of triumph, and then the blonde prodded her still-seated companion, saying, "Let's be going."
"My address," Tweeny began artfully, but Nitz interrupted him.
"I'll take them over." Under the table he gave Marianne a comradely kick. "I'll be along. I want to have a look at this bird."
"Glad to have you," the blonde said.
"Just a moment," Taft Eaton began. "Paul, it seems strange to hear you talk about leaving."
"I don't have to accompany him," Nitz said. "I'm intermission pianist. He can sing some of those stomps and chain gang hollers."
"Can I come?"
Marianne asked in a flurry of misery. She didn't want to be left out. She was helpless to prevent Tweeny and the blonde from mingling, but at least she could be there, too.
"And my girl," Nitz said, rising. "I have to have her with me."
"Bring her." The blonde was already moving toward the street door.
"A party," her companion murmured, glancing at Nitz and Marianne. "Got any more friends?"
"Don't be rude." Halting beside Tweeny, the blonde said,
"My name's Beth, and this is my husband, Danny. Danny Coombs."
"How do you do?" Tweeny said.
"You can't leave," Taft Eaton repeated stubbornly, still there. "Somebody has to do something around here."
"I'm not leaving," Tweeny said. "I explained it fully. I'll do the final set, and then leave."
Putting his hand on Marianne's shoulder, Nitz said to her, "Don't feel bad." She followed morosely after Beth and Danny Coombs, her hands in her pockets.
"I don't want to go, but I have to."
"You'll live through it," Nitz said. He held the red padded door open as Marianne stepped out onto the sidewalk. The Coombses had begun climbing into a parked Ford. "We'll give this guy a hot foot." He crawled into the back seat of the Ford and helped Marianne in. Hugging her comfortingly to him, he reached into his coat and got out his drink glass.
"Ready?"
Beth inquired cheerfully over her shoulder. "Here we go," Nitz said, settling back and yawning.